Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not just what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast is the multiverse, the skeptic's ultimate trump card. Ken will continue to discuss the logic of this proposal on part two of two podcasts. Be sure to listen back to the link of the first one if you missed it. That will inform you as to the discussion so far. But Ken, this is a big one out there. You encounter it all the time on social media. Dave, as a physicist, you're well aware of what scientists are thinking about and writing about on this topic. And even as a layperson, I come across it all the time. And being an editor at RTB, I get the privilege of editing various works on this topic. So it's out there. And Ken, I know you want to do a bit of a recap and then tell us where we're going today.
Yes, that's right, Joe. In our previous show, we talked about, I thought, a very engaging and interesting article about the multiverse. And I will summarize it a little briefly in just a minute. But I hope what we can do in our broadcast as well is in my new book, Christianity Cross-Examined, which hopefully will be out soon, I have seven criticisms of the multiverse. And so I'm going to go through some of that and get Joe, you, and Dave to weigh in on it.
Terrific.
Well, let me just simply, for those who kind of missed our last broadcast, we focused on a article that was in the Scientific American entitled "Our Improbable Existence is No Evidence for a Multiverse." Subtitle: Experts in Probability Have Spotted a Logical Flaw in Theorists' Reasoning. And this was written by Philip Goff, January 10th, 2021. Goff is a philosopher and consciousness researcher at Durham University. Well, in that article, I think Goff makes the case that to believe in a multiverse has certain advantages. I mean, we have fine-tuning in the universe, and if you calculate the chance odds of that probability showing up, it's astronomically low. In fact, Goff mentions here, physicist Lee Smolin has calculated that the odds of life-compatible numbers coming up by chance is 1 in 10 to the 229th, which is a number that I can't even conceive of. But in that article, as we reviewed last time, Goff raises the question that there are problems with the multiverse idea logically, and it has to do with the inverse gambler's fallacy. The gambler's fallacy is just one variety of the false cause fallacy. And the gambler's fallacy is the idea that, you know, if I'm in Vegas and I'm gambling and I've had a bad patch, I've had a bad streak of bad luck, then because of that previous bad luck, it makes it much more likely that I'm now going to be successful. And so this is kind of the gambler's mentality that, you know, I hit a really bad streak, but now I'm due, and so the probabilities are great that I'm gonna win. Well, what Goff says is that there's the inverse fallacy of the inverse gambler's fallacy related to the multiverse, because if you walk up to a table and a person rolls a double six, you may say to yourself, wow, they must have been gambling a long time to get that great roll, because it's so improbable that it would happen on the first roll. But again, Goff points out that the probabilities don't change. If you've had a bad streak, the probabilities remain the same. And if you were to see an extraordinary example, that doesn't necessarily mean that person had been there a long time. So Goff argues that there is a flaw in the multiverse theory. And Dave, I wonder if you could tell us again, why is the multiverse important? What does the multiverse do to the fine tuning? What explanation does it provide, at least in theory?
Well, the idea here is that since our universe is so improbable, if we can propose a theory and find evidence to support the idea that there in fact are a large number of universes out there that we don't necessarily have contact with, but we can somehow demonstrate that they're there. And if there's a huge number of them, a near infinite number, and maybe even an infinite number of them, then there is this very highly likelihood that some of those universes will be fine-tuned like ours. And we happen to live in one of those. If it wasn't fine-tuned, of course, we wouldn't be here. The fact that we're here and it's fine-tuned is highly unlikely, but if there's a large number of them out there, then our existence isn't so unlikely. So, but there's requirements on that. Requirements are that, first of all, we have some mechanism for explaining why there's a large number of universes out there. And secondly, we have an explanation that those universes have different laws of physics, of random parameters defining the laws of physics of those universes. And so some of them could have the particular set of numbers that our constants describing the physics of our universe has. So those are kind of the requirements. But if we can demonstrate that that's true, then we have an explanation, a naturalistic explanation for why our universe is fine-tuned.
So if you have an infinite or a near infinite number, then virtually every scenario is going to play out, and that takes away the tremendous improbability of a number like that.
Correct.
Okay, well, I thought what we could do with the rest of our program is, again, in my new book, Christianity Cross-Examined, I have a chapter on if God created all, who created God. So the question then comes up, does the universe need an explanation? And that then develops into the idea of the multiverse. So I'd like to talk about seven of these criticisms, and Joe and Dave, I'm going to have you, we'll stop at various points, and I want you both to jump in and either raise questions or provide qualification. Dave, in light of your explanation there, the first criticism that I'm going to bring to bear is that currently the multiverse is really an unverifiable and unfalsifiable theory. And that raises questions about whether it's speculation and whether it even qualifies as science. Dave, there are people who suggest that testability is an essential feature in science, and that the multiverse is presently unverifiable or unfalsifiable. In fact, it may never be. We may never have direct empirical evidence to support the idea of the existence of these parallel universes. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, here's a stinging quotation from physicist George Ellis. He says, quote, parallel universes may or may not exist. The case is unproved. We're going to have to live with that uncertainty. Nothing is wrong with scientific-based philosophical speculation, which is what multiverse proposals are, but we should name it for what it is. I think that's a very powerful point, that here is a very well-qualified person in science, Ellis, who says that the idea of parallel universes is philosophical speculation, at present is philosophical speculation, and we should call it for what it is. Dave, what do you think of that?
I guess I have to agree with that. The only evidence that we have is that there's a nice mathematical theory that seems to suggest that it could be possible. But it's so far only a nice mathematical theory that, you know, it's very beautiful, but it doesn't have any, like I say, empirical evidence to support it. And that's what's required to be science.
Now, let me dig just a little deeper, because again, I'm a student of science. I spend most of my time thinking about the history of science and the philosophy of science, but I want to ask you very specifically as a scientist yourself. I mean, you worked in the field. You have a PhD in physics from Caltech. What do you think of the idea that empirical evidence or testing is an essential component of science? I mean, how important is it that we could actually have empirical data? Are people potentially moving away from science by speculating about a multiverse? What are your thoughts about that?
I guess I just agree with Ellis that the scientific method, the thing that everybody touts as being one of the most important methodologies that have ever been discovered and applied and have brought us to the state that we're in understanding our universe, it includes not just theorizing, but then testing to see whether this theory has any merit. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be absent in this particular case. We have this beautiful theory. We have a desire for explaining the fine-tuning in our universe, that life can exist in it. But we don't have any empirical evidence to support the truth of this theory. And so that element, that very important component of the scientific method, is missing at this point. That isn't to say that it couldn't somehow change in the future, but at this point, there is that missing element.
And again, I want to read this quote from Ellis. It's short, but right to the point. He says, quote, "Parallel universes may or may not exist. The case is unproved. We're going to have to live with that uncertainty. Nothing is wrong with scientifically based philosophical speculation, which is what multiverse proposals are, but we should name it for what it is." So that first criticism that I provide in my book, I'm taking from people like Ellis, that the multiverse is at this point unverifiable and unfalsifiable, and it may always be that way, which I think is a potentially devastating criticism. Well, let me move to a second criticism of the multiverse. And again, I'm coming from the standpoint of being a student of the history and philosophy of science. My second criticism is that secular-oriented scientists need to consider whether this theory violates Occam's razor principle with overly complex or conveniently makeshift or ad hoc explanations of the data. What I'm getting at there is, as I understand Occam's razor, let's suppose you have two theories that are set up to explain a specific phenomenon. If both of those theories are fully orbed explanations, then you should give deference to the simpler theory. I think there are simpler explanations for the multiverse, rather than speculating that there is a near infinite number. In fact, let me introduce to you a person who sets forth this idea. This is Christian philosopher Richard Swinburne. He thinks invoking a near infinite number of universes to explain what a single God can do in one universe isn't reasonable. In fact, he says this, again, this is Richard Swinburne. He says, quote, "It is crazy to postulate a trillion causally unconnected universes to explain the features of one universe when postulating one entity, God, will do the job," unquote. So that second criticism has to again do with, are there much simpler explanations? I mean, to postulate a near infinite number, Dave, that seems like a big investment, to say the least.
Yeah, to say the least. You know, I guess it depends on what your worldview is. If you can't, the other explanation, the only one that seems to work, is a creator, is a God out there, an internal being or force or something that has brought our universe into existence. And if you can't in your own thinking accept that as a possible explanation, if that for other reasons goes against the grain, then postulating multiverse, even though it's speculative, is more satisfying.
Now I think you've hit on something very, very powerful there, that worldview considerations are very important at this point. And if you are a naturalist, and if your thinking says I can only accept a naturalistic explanation, then I'm going to set aside what might be a simpler explanation of a single God creating the world, as is set forth in the Judeo-Christian scriptures. And the reason I have to set that aside is that I've already determined that there are only certain explanations I'm going to accept, namely naturalistic. And what I want to say is, a lot of times when we talk about scientific issues, what isn't always seen and identified is that there are philosophical presuppositions that are brought to the table that influence the way we think about science.
That's right. They sort of inoculate us against certain ideas or viewpoints that we're not willing to concern or to accept or to think about. I have a friend who's an atheist, and I wrote him a text recently. I said, I asked him how he was doing, and I said, I have a question for you. I said, my observation is that some people don't come to faith in God unless there is some crisis in their life. Mm. And it's through crisis that they kind of become awakened to the possibility that there is a God, and through it come to faith. I said, you know, of course, I said, I know that you don't believe that there is a God or that Christianity is true, but I said, suppose for a moment that it is true and that there really is a God as described in the Bible. I said, would you want this God to bring a crisis into your life so that you would have the opportunity to come to know the truth and not miss out? So I asked him that question. Well, when we finally had a conversation about that question, of course, he didn't like that. He didn't like the idea that God has to bring crisis into our life. Why can't he just tell us? But I said, the reason he can't just tell us is because we have so many ideas already in our head that inoculate us against knowing what the truth is. We're not willing to consider them. And it's not until a crisis occurs in our life of some form that we're now willing to consider things that we weren't willing to consider before. And I think that's the dilemma that some of these naturalists find themselves in.
Yeah, I, you know, about a year ago, my wife had a mammogram, and when the doctor got the results, he said, well, there's something here in the breast that is concerning. You know, they weren't saying that it was cancerous, but it was something that they didn't expect. And so my wife had to undergo a second mammogram, actually a biopsy. And that biopsy was inconclusive. And then there was another one done, and that was inconclusive. And of course, all the time that this process is going on, which is a lengthy process lasting weeks and months, to some degree, our whole world was turned upside down. You know, I'm thinking, wow, what could this be? What are the implications of this? And our kids are thinking, you know, so the idea that, you know, my old boss, Walter Martin, used to say, some people won't look up until they're flat on their back.
That's right.
So sometimes you won't examine the implications of your worldview unless a crisis comes. And yeah, I don't want to go too far down this road because I want to keep us on the track of the right. multiverse. But I do want to say this, a naturalist worldview, it seems to me, is very stark. In the end of my book, Christianity Cross-Examined, I asked the question, who has the last say in your worldview? And I propose that in naturalism, it's entropy that has the last say. I mean, if there's no God, no mind behind the universe, then we're going to die. We're going to die soon. We'll die alone, and we'll be dead forever. Dave, that's a very difficult worldview to come to grips with. Could it be that people avoid it because it is very stark?
I think so.
All right. Well, Joe, you want to jump in? You want me to move on?
You can move on.
Okay. Here's a third criticism. I'm assuming here that a multiverse could fall into the fallacy of the infinite regression. You know, somebody may say, for example, that, well, who created our universe? And, you know, I say, well, God did. And then Richard Dawkins come along and says, well, who created God? Because he says that. And so does Lawrence Krauss. And what if I said, well, God squared? Well, who created him? Well, God to the third power. Well, who created him? God to the fourth power. Aristotle, who is arguably the most logical thinker in the history of Western civilization, he is actually the father of logic. He wasn't the first man to think logically, but he was the first person to systematize the principles of reasoning, and we call him Aristotelian logic. We call him the father of logic as an exalted title. But Aristotle said, look, that can't keep going on, because if you just keep pushing back the explanation, then nothing is ever explained. There has to be something or someone that moves but is himself unmoved. Dave, it seems to me that sometimes when people speculate about a multiverse, they almost talk as if it has meta laws that are kind of outside the universe. And this seems to put the multiverse explanation maybe outside of physics. What do you think of that?
You know, that certainly seems to be the direction that Stephen Hawking was going in speculating that the fundamental things in the world are these laws of physics. And then from those laws somehow create and bring about the universes that we see. But you still have to answer the question, who created the law, these these meta laws or these ultimate laws of physics. And I don't know where they go from there. They don't have an explanation. They just say they're brute force reality. They're eternal. Mm-hmm.
So the criticism I'm bringing to bear here is if you just keep backing it up and you have no explanation for what is potentially the meta laws, or as you identified, Stephen Hawking said, well, the law of gravity could bring the universe into existence. But then people say, well, isn't the law of gravity a part of the universe already? Joe, it seems like this is potentially taking us down the fallacious road of an infinite regression fallacy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ken, I probably should have brought this up earlier, and Dave, you can help me out with it, but there might be people listening who would say, hey, I thought Jeff Zwirink has written about different levels of multiverse theory, and level one in particular is not that big a deal. I don't think Jeff would say anything different than what we're saying here, right, Dave? He might say that level one is really this universe, just the unobservable part, but then you get into other areas of speculation, and that's what we're talking about. Is that somewhere along the lines there?
I mean, even the idea that our particular universe extends an infinite distance out beyond what we can actually see is one form of a multiverse, and that there may be regions of this infinitely large universe that has the laws of physics being fine-tuned, where other regions are not fine-tuned. So whether it's a bubble universe or whether it's just an extension of ours, it still is speculated to have these properties that can explain our fine-tuning. Mm-hmm. Of course, what he's emphasizing in his little book, we don't need to be afraid of the multiverse as Christians, is that even these infinite number of universes haven't been there forever. They're not eternally present. It's not all the evidence, all the proofs, the mathematical proofs that have come to bear on this subject so far indicate that there still had to be a beginning. Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me move to a fourth criticism, I want to underscore that this is an existential criticism, and I guess I want to explain a little bit about that word. I hear politicians saying, global warming is an existential crisis. Well, I think in some ways they mean it similarly, but also maybe not so similar to what philosophers mean when they talk about something being existential. I would say philosophically, when you talk about an existential point perspective, you're dealing with meaning and purpose and ultimate issues. And maybe politicians think, well, global warming may be so destructive that it will upend, life in our world. But I'm dealing more with this question of the meaning of life and ultimate purpose. So here's my fourth criticism. And it begins with the question, are secular scientists willing to go all in on an unobservable and unverifiable and possibly or probably unverifiable theory when they criticize Christians for considering Pascal's wager? Now, let me say something again, just kind of giving some explanation. I think a lot of people dismiss Pascal's wager and they never understand it. I think a lot of people, for example, when they think about Pascal's wager, they think it's an independent argument for God's existence all by itself. And they ignore, I think, the context Pascal was making. I mean, let me give it briefly. Pascal is living in 17th century science. He's one of the founding fathers of science. He's a physicist, a mathematician. And he knows there's kind of two options in two worldview options in France at that time. You were either going to be a Christian, which for him it would be Catholic, or you're going to be an atheist. But Pascal knew a lot of science-oriented people. He knew the STEM people of the time. And he knew that a lot of them were kind of agnostics. They didn't know, well, I'm not terribly comfortable with Catholicism, but neither am I necessarily committed to the stark reality of atheism. So they just put it off and just say, I don't know. And so Pascal came up with this this cost-benefit analysis of basically saying, look, let's conceive of life after death. How could you potentially win and how could you potentially lose? And Pascal says, look, if you believe in God and you're right, you'll be adopted into his family and live eternally. So you hit the jackpot. But if you disbelieve in God and God does exist, you will suffer the wrath of God. And so Pascal says, look, just from a standpoint of cost-benefit analysis, you have everything to win by believing. You could lose by believing. You might waste your life or you may not enjoy all the pleasures, earthly pleasures you could.
Pleasures of sin.
But you stand to lose everything by disbelieving. And so Pascal, by the way, who was a gambler, at least before his Christian commitment, the funny thing they said about Pascal is he very seldom ever lost. And he was he is one of the people that developed probability theory. It'd be interesting to have an interview with Pascal about the multiverse. So here is the question again, in light of people who are critical of Pascal's wager, hey, you don't know what's going to happen in death. Why are you engaging in a cost-benefit analysis? Seems like pure speculation. Well, on an existential level, secular scientists seem to be going all in on this when they know it's unobservable and it may never be verifiable. So I'm asking for some consistency here. If it's wrong for me to use the wager argument because it's speculation, well, couldn't I say the same about the multiverse?
Very good. Mm-hmm. I think you're right.
All right, let me shuffle my cards here a little bit and move to my fifth criticism. The question I want to raise here is the multiverse seems to imply the existence of something supernatural or above the natural realm of reality. So can a theory dependent on forces outside of time and space be considered naturalistic? I guess the criticism I'm bringing to bear here, Joe and Dave, is when scientists talk about the multiverse, at times they seem to talk about meta laws. I even wonder whether the multiverse really is a naturalistic theory. I think that's the point of my criticism, that sometimes when the multiverse is described, it doesn't seem to be purely naturalistic, at least the way naturalism has often been associated with physicalism and materialism. I mean, I definitely think that's the case with Stephen Hawking. When he talks about it, it almost seems supernatural.
You know, I think that they're willing to consider something that is near supernatural or is the next thing to supernatural, as long as they're not talking about a person that they have to be accountable to. I think a lot of these scientists are willing to consider the deist form of God, where there may be some God of some form who made this universe and then went away, and that we don't ultimately have to deal with him. He's not either not a person or he's a person that is absent. But when what I find kind of interesting is if there's an infinite number of universes out there, how do they know it isn't possible that one of these universes has laws of physics to such a fine tuning that there's a Superman in that universe, some individual that has powers and would be able to be in some form a god to whom that we would have to be accountable.
So again, I mean, to go back to Ellis's point of philosophical speculation, and again, to kind of remind people that you know, to talk about cosmology, it almost spills over into, well, it's origin questions. And when you get to origin questions, it's easy to enter into the world of speculation, and people have presuppositions. Joe, I know you're a little bit fond of the presuppositional approach to apologetic. I have to say, I think one of the contributions that the presuppositional approach, this is tied to Van Til, who was a professor at Westminster Seminary in the 20th century, and it's pretty popular among evangelicals, particularly in the Reformed tradition. But one of the things that presuppositionalists often remind us is that we bring a lot of presuppositions to the table, and you need to be aware of those presuppositions. And if you're using them, I can challenge them. I want you to tell me how you justify your presuppositions. And David, it seems to me there are times when we talk about kind of ultimate explanations that there are these philosophical assumptions that sometimes scientists are either not aware of or are using without justifying.
Yes. You know, it's interesting that in years gone by, a scientist didn't want to consider explanations that were supernatural, or I would call transcendent. In other words, due to causes outside of our world. And in fact, this is the point that Carl Sagan makes, that this universe, this cosmos, is all there is, ever was, and ever will be. Mm-hmm. But because of the fine tuning, we've now been forced to consider transcendent arguments, which are, in a sense, supernatural arguments. So you're absolutely right.
So this isn't your mother's naturalism.
That's right. Exactly.
Okay, well, let me present a sixth criticism here. Some of the leading proponents of multiverse theories have accepted the idea that an expanding universe must have had a beginning. For example, after examining the theories that claim to avoid a need for a beginning in the universe, cosmologist Alex Vilenkin said this. He said, quote, "None of these scenarios can actually be past eternal, and all the evidence we have says the universe had a beginning." So part of the question of the multiverse is, it then asks the question, well, is Big Bang cosmology exactly right in that it had a singular beginning? Maybe it's the beginning of this universe, but it's not the beginning of everything. And Vilenkin says, none of these scenarios can actually be past eternal, and all the evidence we have says the universe had a beginning.
And by the universe, he means he's including the multiverse.
Yeah. So, you know, as much as there is discussion, I mean, I've read some atheists say, well, the Big Bang's 50 years old. It's kind of, you know, it's past its usefulness. But as Hugh Ross often says, you know, the extensive testing indicates that it's still the best explanation. And instead of postulating that maybe there are all these kind of universes that spark other universes, Belenkin, who's a leading thinker in his field, of course, says these scenarios are not past eternal. And the evidence we have is that our universe had a beginning, and Dave, it may be the beginning of everything.
That's right.
As creation ex nihilo indicates.
Yep.
All right, here's number seven, seventh criticism. By the way, seven is the number of completion. So notice that I'm using numerology here. just kidding. Don't take that and think I'm a numerologist. I say this in number seven, even if the multiverse model emerges as viably correct, the view in general could still be compatible with Christian theism. And here I'm suggesting that scripture teaches that God created at least one other realm of existence beside the time-space world. Dave and Joe, scripture does talk about an angelic realm. We don't get a lot of details. I'm always a little critical of people who try to think they know more about Lucifer and the devil and the demons than maybe they really can explain. But I think it's very clear that before God created our universe and long before he created human beings, he did create another realm of being. And so, Dave and Joe, it could be possible that creation is more extensive and complex than we know. So even if there are other universes, the best explanation of them could still be God.
Mm, yeah, good point.
Now here's what Jeff Swearing says. Jeff's, of course, my colleague here at Reasons to Believe, and this issue is much more in his bailiwick than it is in mine, although I'm trying to make a philosophical case critiquing it. Jeff says, quote, "Rather than get stuck on whether we live in a multiverse, I prefer to focus on the more important question, does a multiverse fit more comfortably in a naturalist worldview or the Christians? Upon my first exposure to the multiverse, I thought it was a threat to Christianity. However, further investigation revealed that multiverse research strengthens the case for a beginning and for design, and thus a beginner and a designer." So I think that's a pretty important point, that even if the universe, or even if creation is more extensive than we thought and doesn't end just in our time-space world, we have some indication that God was invested in creation beyond this world. Mm-hmm. Namely, the creation of a realm in which there are angelic beings. So the multiverse, depending on how it's defined, could be compatible with Christian theism. Mm-hmm. Now, let me... one of my favorite thinkers, science thinkers, besides, of course, Dave Rogstad, who's number one on the list. I like Paul Davies a lot. And I'll tell you why I like Paul Davies. He is, of course, a physicist and a cosmologist. I think, though, the reason I like him is when he talks about science issues, he never seems to give... an indication that he's angry or, you know, is willing to kind of exclude religiosity. Of course, he received the Templeton Award. And I think Davies has even spoke positively about religion. I'm assuming he's, you know, at least an agnostic. You know, I've never had the privilege of talking with him personally, but, you know, when he talks about science, he says, well, scientists operate as if they have a theological worldview. And I appreciate that about him. And, but the real reason I like him is one day he said he was reading St. Augustine. So I thought, well, he has to be my favorite cosmologist after that. But I have a quotation from him here that I think is very interesting, and I want to share it with you. He says, quote, extreme multiverse explanations. And I, Joe, I think that's kind of the level one, level two. There are differing ideas. Mm-hmm. He says, extreme multiverse explanations are therefore reminiscent of theological discussions. Indeed, invoking an infinity of unseen universes to explain the usual features of the one we do see is just as ad hoc as invoking an unseen creator. The multiverse theory may be dressed up in scientific language, but in essence, it requires the same leap of faith. Now, there's a couple things I want to say about that. Number one is Davies thinks it is speculation, and he thinks that it is virtually religious in orientation. Now, what's interesting is some people would come along and say, look, at least Christians admit it is a matter of faith. Now, we don't think it's wishful thinking faith. We think it's reasonable faith. But Davies seems to be indicating, Joe and Dave, that the multiverse, it's just as ad hoc as any kind of religious explanation, which in scientific circles carries a lot of criticism. Mm-hmm. So I think Davies would say, in terms of science, the multiverse doesn't carry any more explanation than a theological explanation. What do you think of that point, Dave and Joe?
Yes, no more weight.
And I mean, that's a very powerful point. Now of course, I want to critique it a little bit and say, well, look, I don't think the Christian explanation is purely ad hoc, because I want to bring into existence other things that I think need to be explained beside the fine-tuning, consciousness and mathematics, and of course, the most extraordinary life that was ever lived, the life of Jesus of Nazareth. And so I don't think the Christian worldview is merely ad hoc, but I think if we take it in the way that Davies intended it, he's essentially saying that the multiverse is no more scientific than what you would find in the book of Genesis, declaring that there was a creator who brought all matter, energy, space, and time into existence from nothing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a pretty powerful point. Having gone through those explanations, I just want to sum up a little bit here. I want to bring us back. I want to bring us back to this question of looking at the universe. It seems to me that the multiverse is not a serious obstacle to the Christian view of cosmology. There are questions that are very serious about it. It may be, it is at least unverifiable. It may never be verifiable. In terms of a scientific theory, it seems to extend beyond things that some people think are absolutely necessary to have a scientific theory, namely that we can somehow empirically verify or falsify it. And of course, it could even conceivably be consistent with Christian theism. And so I would think the Christian at that point has a greater explanatory power and scope than does naturalism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ken, I have one question. You may have already dealt with this, and if so, it's my bad, I forgot. But in the article that you introduced in the first podcast, the author talks about people who are trying to find a way out, and they talked about a monkey having a go at a typewriter and composing an essay. And the criticism of that was, we see that monkey, but we have to deal with that composition right now. We don't know about the existence of all these other monkeys who have had an eternity to have a go at a typewriter. So I think he was calling it this selection effect. Did you already talk about that? I'm sorry if I missed that, but he didn't find that an escape route.
Yeah, right. I don't think I touched on it explicitly. More the selection effect that I kind of shifted to was, you know, the idea, well, of course there must have been a multiverse, because without it we wouldn't be able to explain fine-tuning.
Yeah.
And we couldn't know fine-tuning unless we were here to observe it.
Yeah, okay. I remember that. Yeah, okay.
And again, I would draw attention to Swinburne, who says, you know, if somebody is before a firing squad and everybody misses, the question is not that the guy's still standing there because they missed. The question is, why did all of these experts miss? Yeah. And I think Goff may be also getting at the issue that you need to keep it focused on the right question. And the right question is, why, what explains the multiverse? Not that we just happen to be here because of its truth. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let me simply say that this list that I gave you here is, it's chapter 4 in my book that I'm looking forward to seeing published soon, Christianity Cross-Examined, and you can read that. But Joe and Dave, that we have a lot of good sources on this. Jeff Swearink, who is afraid of the multiverse, and Jeff and Hugh, I know, have addressed it as I have in some of my blog articles. So we have lots of good material responding to this challenge.
Yeah. Thank you for that. In fact, if you come to our website, reasons.org, and simply type in multiverse, you'll get all kinds of resources there, video recordings, as well as Jeff's various blogs on the topic. So thanks, Ken. This has been really good. I look forward to, well, I've already read your chapter because I helped edit your book, but I'm sure our readers will look forward to that chapter so they can have these seven criticisms, which I think are very well done.
Can I suggest that we tell people how they can get this article by Goff if they were to do a Google search on the title of this article? Can you tell us the title?
Yes. Yes. Again, this is Philip Goff, G-O-F-F. The title is Our Improbable Existence is No Evidence for a Multiverse. And it is scientificamerican.com.
So if people want to read that article,
yeah,
that's a reference for it.
And I have it on my Facebook site for anybody who is a Facebook friend.
Okay.
Terrific. All right. Well, thanks again. Thank you for listening to this podcast. As you can tell, we're still recording from our various corners as we deal with the pandemic. So we trust you're patient with us and understanding. We look forward to being in studio again one of these days soon. This podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Look for the Reasons to Believe podcast and you'll find Straight Thinking there. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory, but truth. Thanks for listening and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.